Chapter 17. We make further investigations. I have set down the Beraldi case in full. Of course, all the details did not present themselves to my memory as I have recounted them here. Nevertheless, I recall the case fairly accurately. It had attracted a great deal of interest at the time, and had been fully reported by the English papers, so that it did not need much effort of memory on my part to recollect the salient details. Just for the moment, in my excitement, it seemed to clear up the whole matter. I admit that I am impulsive, and Poirot deplores my custom of jumping to conclusions, but I think I had some excuse in this instance. The remarkable way in which this discovery justified Poirot's point of view struck me at once. "Poirot," I said, "I congratulate you. I see everything now." Poirot lit one of his little cigarettes with his usual precision. Then he looked up. "And since you see everything now, mon ami, what exactly is it that you see?" "Why, that it was Madame Dobray, Beraldi, who murdered Mr. Renault. The similarity of the two cases proves that beyond a doubt."
"Then you consider that Madame Beraldi was wrongly acquitted? That in actual fact she was guilty of connivance at her husband's murder?"
I opened my eyes wide. "Well, of course. Don't you?" Poirot walked to the end of the room, absent-mindedly straightening a chair, and then said thoughtfully,
"Yes, that is my opinion. But there is no of course about it, my friend. Technically speaking, Madame Beraldi is innocent."
"Well, of that crime, perhaps, but not of this."
Poirot sat down again and regarded me, his thoughtful air more marked than ever.
"So, it is definitely your opinion, Hastings, that Madame Debray murdered Monsieur Renault?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
He shot the question at me with such suddenness that I was taken aback.
"Why?" I stammered. "Why? Because...
I came to a stop.
Poirot nodded his head at me.
"You see, you come to a stumbling block at once. Why should Madame Dobray, I shall call her that for clearness' sake, murder Monsieur Renault? We can find no shadow of a motive. She does not benefit by his death. Considered as either mistress or blackmailer, she stands to lose. You cannot have a murder without motive. The first crime was different. There we had a rich lover waiting to step into her husband's shoes."
"Money is not the only motive for murder," I objected.
"True," agreed Poirot placidly. "There are two others. The crime passionnel is one. And there is the third rare motive, murder for an idea, which implies some form of mental derangement on the part of the murderer. Homicidal mania and religious fanaticism belong to that class. We can rule it out here."
"But what about crime passionnel? Can you rule that out? If Madame Dobray was Renault's mistress, if she found that his affection was cooling, or if her jealousy was aroused in any way, might she not have struck him down in a moment of anger?"
Poirot shook his head.
"If, I say if, you know, Madame Dobray was Renault's mistress, he had not had time to tire of her, and in any case, you mistake her character. She is a woman who can simulate great emotional stress. She is a magnificent actress, but looked at dispassionately, her life disproves her appearance. Throughout, if we examine it, she has been cold-blooded and calculating in her motives and actions. It was not to link her life with that of her young lover that she connived at her husband's murder. The rich American, for whom she probably did not care a button, was her objective. If she committed a crime, she would always do it for gain. Here, there was no gain. Besides, how do you account for the digging of the grave? That was man's work."
"She might have had an accomplice," I suggested, unwilling to relinquish my belief.
"I pass to another objection. You have spoken of the similarity between the two crimes. Wherein does that lie, my friend?"
I stared at him in astonishment.
"Why, Poirot, it was you who remarked on that. The story of the masked men. The secret, the papers."
Poirot smiled a little.
"Do not be so indignant, I beg of you. I repudiate nothing. The similarity of the two stories links the two cases together inevitably. But reflect now on something very curious. It is not Madame Dobray who tells us this tale. If it were, all would indeed be plain sailing. it is Madame Renaud. Is she, then, in league with the other?
I can't believe that, I said slowly. If she is, she must be the most consummate actress the world has ever known.
Ta-ta-ta, said Poirot impatiently. Again you have the sentiment and not the logic. If it is necessary for a criminal to be a consummate actress, then by all means assume her to be one. But is it necessary?
I do not believe Madame Renaud to be in league with Madame Dubreuil for several reasons, some of which I have already enumerated to you. The others are self-evident. Therefore, that possibility eliminated, we draw very near to the truth, which is, as always, very curious and interesting.
Poirot, I cried, what more do you know?
Mon ami, you must make your own deductions. You have access to the facts.
Concentrate your grey cells. Reason, not like Giraud, but like Hercule Poirot.
But are you sure? My friend, in many ways I have been an imbecile, but at last I see clearly.
You know everything?
I have discovered what Monsieur Renaud sent for me to discover.
And you know the murderer?
I know one murderer.
What do you mean?
We talk a little at cross-purposes. There are here not one crime, but two. The first I have solved. The second, eh bien, I will confess, I am not sure.
But Poirot, I thought you said the man in the shed had died a natural death.
Ta, ta, ta. Poirot made his favorite ejaculation of impatience.
Still you do not understand. One may have a crime without a murderer, but for two crimes it is essential to have two bodies.
His remark struck me as so peculiarly lacking in lucidity that I looked at him in some anxiety, but he appeared perfectly normal. Suddenly he rose and strolled to the window.
"Here he is," he observed.
"Who?"
"Monsieur Jacques Renaud.
I sent a note up to the villa to ask him to come here."
Well, that changed the course of my ideas, and I asked Poirot if he knew that Jacques Renaud had been in Merlinville on the night of the crime. I had hoped to catch my astute little friend napping, but as usual, he was omniscient. He, too, had inquired at the station.
"And without doubt, we are not original in the idea, Hastings. The excellent Giraud, he also has probably made his inquiries."
"Well, you don't think—"
I said, and then stopped.
"Oh, no, it would be too horrible."
Poirot looked inquiringly at me, but I said no more. It had just occurred to me that, though there were seven women, directly and indirectly connected with the case, Mrs. Renaud, Madame Dubreuil, and her daughter, the mysterious visitor, and the three servants, there was, with the exception of old Auguste, who could hardly count, only one man, Jacques Renaud. And a man must have dug the grave. I had no time to develop further the appalling idea that had occurred to me, for Jacques Renaud was ushered into the room. Poirot greeted him in a businesslike manner.
"Take a seat, monsieur.
I regret infinitely to derange you, but you will perhaps understand that the atmosphere of the villa is not too congenial to me. Monsieur Giraud and I do not see eye to eye about everything. His politeness to me has not been striking, and you will comprehend that I do not intend any little discoveries I may make to benefit him in any way."
"Exactly, Monsieur Poirot," said the lad.
"That fellow Giraud is an ill-conditioned brute, and I'd be delighted to see someone score at his expense."
"Then may I ask a little favor of you?"
"Certainly."
"I will ask you to go to the railway station and take a train to the next station along the line, Abelac. Ask at the cloakroom whether two foreigners deposited a valise there on the night of the murder. It is a small station, and they are almost certain to remember.
Will you do this?"
"Of course I will," said the boy, mystified, though ready for the task.
"I and my friend, you comprehend, have business elsewhere," explained Poirot.
"There is a train in a quarter of an hour, and I will ask you not to return to the villa, as I have no wish for Giraud to get an inkling of your errand."
"Very well. I'll go straight to the station."
He rose to his feet.
Poirot's voice stopped him.
One moment, Monsieur Renaud. There is one little matter that puzzles me. Why did you not mention to Monsieur Otey this morning that you were in Merlinville on the night of the crime?"
Jacques Renaud's face went crimson. With an effort, he controlled himself.
"You've made a mistake.
I was in Cherbourg, as I told the examining magistrate this morning. Poirot looked at him. His eyes narrowed, cat-like, until they only showed a gleam of green.
Then it is a singular mistake that I have made there, for it is shared by the station staff. They say you arrived by the 11:40 train.
For a moment, Jack Renault hesitated. Then he made up his mind.
And if I did?
I suppose you do not mean to accuse me of participating in my father's murder? He asked the question haughtily, his head thrown back.
I should like an explanation of the reason that brought you here.
Well, that is simple enough. I came to see my fiancée, Mademoiselle de Breuil. I was on the eve of a long voyage, uncertain as to when I should return. I wished to see her before I went, to assure her of my unchanging devotion.
And did you see her?
Poirot's eyes never left the other's face. There was an appreciable pause before Renault replied. Then he said,
Yes. And afterwards?
I found I had missed the last train. I walked to Saint-Beauvais, where I knocked up a garage and got a car to take me back to Cherbourg.
Saint-Beauvais? That is 15 kilometers. A long walk, Monsieur Renault.
I felt like walking.
Poirot bowed his head as a sign that he accepted the explanation. Jack Renault took up his hat and cane and departed. In a trice, Poirot jumped to his feet.
Quick, Hastings, we will go after him.
Keeping a discreet distance behind our quarry, we followed him through the streets of Merlinville. But when Poirot saw that he took the turning to the station, he checked himself.
All is well. He has taken the bait. He will go to Abelac and will inquire for the mythical valise left by the mythical foreigners. Yes, mon ami. All of that was a little invention of my own.
You wanted him out of the way, I exclaimed.
Your penetration is amazing, Hastings. Now, if you please, we will go up to the Villa Genevieve.
Chapter 18. Giraud Acts. Arrived at the villa, Poirot led the way up to the shed where the second body had been discovered. He did not, however, go in, but paused by the bench which I have mentioned before as being set some few yards away from it. After contemplating it for a moment or two, he paced carefully from it to the hedge, which marked the boundary between the Villa Genevieve and the Villa Marguerite. Then he paced back again, nodding his head as he did so. Returning again to the hedge, he parted the bushes with his hands.
With good fortune, he remarked to me over his shoulder, Mademoiselle Marthe may find herself in the garden. I desire to speak to her, and would prefer not to call formally at the Villa Marguerite. Ah, all is well. There she is. Psst, mademoiselle, psst, un moment, s'il vous plaît.
I joined him at the moment that Marthe de Breuil, looking slightly startled, came running up to the hedge at his call.
A little word with you, mademoiselle, if it is permitted.
Certainly, Monsieur Poirot.
Despite her acquiescence, her eyes looked troubled and afraid.
Mademoiselle, do you remember running after me on the road the day that I came to your house with the examining magistrate? You asked me if anyone was suspected of the crime. And you told me 2 Chileans.
Her voice sounded rather breathless, and her left hand stole to her breast.
Will you ask me the same question again, mademoiselle?
What do you mean?
This. If you were to ask me that question again, I should give you a different answer. Someone is suspected, but not a Chilean.
Who?
The word came faintly between her parted lips.
Monsieur Jacques Renault.
What?
It was a cry.
Jack? Impossible. Who dares to suspect him?
Giraud.
Giraud?
The girl's face was ashy.
I am afraid of that man. He is cruel. He will...
She broke off. There was courage gathering in her face and determination. I realized in that moment that she was a fighter. Poirot, too, watched her intently.
You know, of course, that he was here on the night of the murder?
He asked.
Yes, she replied mechanically. He told me.
It was unwise to have tried to conceal the fact, ventured Poirot.
Yes, yes, she replied impatiently, but we cannot waste time on regrets. We must find something to save him. He is innocent, of course, but that will not help him with a man like Giraud, who has his reputation to think of. He must arrest someone, and that someone will be Jack.
The facts will tell against him, said Poirot. You realize that?
She faced him squarely.
I am not a child, monsieur. I can be brave and look facts in the face. He is innocent, and we must save him.
She spoke with a kind of desperate energy, then was silent, frowning as she thought.
Mademoiselle, said Poirot, observing her keenly, is there not something you are keeping back that you could tell us?
She nodded perplexedly.
Yes, there is something. But I hardly know whether you will believe it. It seems so absurd.
At any rate, tell us, mademoiselle.
It is this. Monsieur Giraud sent for me, as an afterthought, to see if I could identify the man in there.
She signed with her head towards the shed.
I could not. At least, I could not at the moment. But since, I have been thinking...
Well?
It seems so queer, and yet I am almost sure. I will tell you. On the morning of the day Monsieur Renaud was murdered, I was walking in the garden here, when I heard a sound of men's voices, quarrelling. I pushed aside the bushes and looked through. One of the men was Monsieur Renaud, and the other was a tramp, a dreadful-looking creature in filthy rags. He was alternately whining and threatening. I gathered he was asking for money. But at that moment, Maman called me from the house, and I had to go. That is all. Only, I am almost sure that the tramp and the dead man in the shed are one and the same.
Poirot uttered an exclamation.
But why did you not say at the time, mademoiselle?
Because at first it only struck me that the face was vaguely familiar in some way. The man was differently dressed and apparently belonged to a superior station in life.
A voice called from the house.
Maman, whispered Marta, I must go.
And she slipped away through the trees.
Come, said Poirot,
and taking my arm, turned in the direction of the villa.
What do you really think?
I asked in some curiosity.
Was that story true, or did the girl make it up, in order to divert suspicion from her lover?
It is a curious tale, said Poirot, but I believe it to be the absolute truth.
Unwittingly, Mademoiselle Marthe told us the truth on another point, and incidentally gave Jacques Renaud the lie.
Did you notice his hesitation when I asked him if he saw Marthe Dubreuil on the night of the crime? He paused, and then said yes. I suspected that he was lying. It was necessary for me to see Mademoiselle Marthe before he could put her on her guard. Three little words gave me the information I wanted. When I asked her if she knew that Jacques Renaud was here that night, she answered, he told me. Now, Hastings, what was Jacques Renaud doing here on that eventful evening? And if he did not see Mademoiselle Marthe, whom did he see?
Oh, surely, Poirot, I cried aghast. You cannot believe that a boy like that would murder his own father.
Mon ami, said Poirot, you continue to be of a sentimentality unbelievable. I have seen mothers who murdered their little children for the sake of the insurance money. After that, one can believe anything.
And the motive? Money, of course.
Remember that Jacques Renaud thought that he would come into half his father's fortune at the latter's death.
But the tramp, where does he come in?
Poirot shrugged his shoulders. Giraud would say that he was an accomplice, an Apache, who helped young Renaud to commit the crime, and who was conveniently put out of the way afterwards.
But the hair on the dagger?
The woman's hair?
Ah, said Poirot, smiling broadly. That is the cream of Giraud's little jest. According to him, it is not a woman's hair at all. Remember that the youths of today wear their hair brushed straight back from the forehead with pomade or hair wash to make it lie flat? Consequently, some of the hairs are of considerable length.
And you believe that too?
No,
said Poirot, with a curious smile, for I know it to be the hair of a woman. And more, which woman?
Madame Dubreuil, I announced positively.
Perhaps, said Poirot, regarding me quizzically, but I refused to allow myself to get annoyed.
What are we going to do now? I asked, as we entered the hall of the Villa Genevieve.
I wish to make a search among the effects of Monsieur Jacques Renaud.
That is why I had to get him out of the way for a few hours. Neatly and methodically, Poirot opened each drawer in turn, examined the contents, and returned them exactly to their places. It was a singularly dull and uninteresting proceeding. Poirot waded on through collars, pajamas, and socks. A purring noise outside drew me to the window. Instantly, I became galvanized into life. "Poirot!" I cried. "A car has just driven up. Giraud is in it, and Jack Renault and two gendarmes."
"Sacré tonnerre!" growled Poirot. "That animal of a Giraud! Could he not wait? I shall not be able to replace the things in this last drawer with the proper method. Let us be quick!"
Unceremoniously, he tumbled out the things onto the floor, mostly ties and handkerchief. Suddenly, with a cry of triumph, Poirot pounced on something. A small square of cardboard, evidently a photograph. Thrusting it into his pocket, he returned the things pell-mell to the drawer, and seizing me by the arm, dragged me out of the room and down the stairs. In the hall stood Giraud, contemplating his prisoner.
"Good afternoon, Monsieur Giraud," said Poirot. "What have we here?"
Giraud nodded his head towards Jack.
"He was trying to make a getaway, but I was too sharp for him. He is under arrest for the murder of his father, Monsieur Paul Renault."
Poirot wheeled round to confront the boy, who was leaning limply against the door, his face ashy pale.
"What do you say to that, jeune homme?"
Jack Renault stared at him stonily.
"Nothing," he said.
Chapter 19. I Use My Grey Cells. I was dumbfounded. Up to the last, I had not been able to bring myself to believe Jack Renault guilty. I had expected a ringing proclamation of his innocence when Poirot challenged him. But now, watching him as he stood white and limp against the wall, and hearing the damning admission fall from his lips, I doubted no longer. But Poirot had turned to Giraud.
"What are your grounds for arresting him?"
"Do you expect me to give them to you?"
"As a matter of courtesy, yes."
Giraud looked at him doubtfully. He was torn between a desire to refuse rudely and the pleasure of triumphing over his adversary.
"You think I have made a mistake, I suppose," he sneered.
"It would not surprise me," replied Poirot with a soupçon of malice.
Giraud's face took on a deeper tinge of red.
"Eh bien, come in here. You shall judge for yourself."
He flung open the door of the salon and we passed in, leaving Jack Renault in the care of the two other men.
"Now, Monsieur Poirot,"
said Giraud, laying his hat on the table and speaking with the utmost sarcasm,
"I will treat you to a little lecture on detective work. I will show how we moderns work."
"Bien,"
said Poirot, composing himself to listen.
"I will show you how admirably the old guard can listen."
And he leaned back and closed his eyes, opening them for a moment to remark,
"Do not fear that I shall sleep. I will attend most carefully."
"Of course," began Giraud. "I soon saw through all that Chilean tomfoolery. Two men were in it. But they were not mysterious foreigners. All that was a blind."
"Very creditable so far, my dear Giraud," murmured Poirot, "especially after that clever trick of theirs with the match and the cigarette end."
Giraud glared, but continued.
"A man must have been connected with the case in order to dig the grave. There is no man who actually benefits by the crime, but there was a man who thought he would benefit. I heard of Jacques Renault's quarrel with his father, and of the threats that he had used. The motive was established. Now, as to means. Jacques Renault was in Merlinville that night. He concealed the fact, which turned suspicion into certainty. Then we found a second victim, stabbed with the same dagger. We know when that dagger was stolen. Captain Hastings here can fix the time. Jacques Renault, arriving from Cherbourg, was the only person who could have taken it. I have accounted for all the other members of the household."
Poirot interrupted.
"You are wrong. There is one other person who could have taken the dagger."
"You refer to Monsieur Stoner. He arrived at the front door in an automobile which had brought him straight from Calais. Ah, believe me, I have looked into everything. Monsieur Jacques Renault arrived by train. An hour elapsed between his arrival and the moment when he presented himself at the house. Without doubt, he saw Captain Hastings and his companion leave the shed, slipped in himself, and took the dagger, stabbed his accomplice in the shed, who was already dead."
Giraud shrugged his shoulders.
"Possibly he did not observe that. He may have judged him to be sleeping. Without doubt, they had a rendezvous. In any case, he knew this apparent second murder would greatly complicate the case. It did.
But it could not deceive Monsieur Giraud, murmured Poirot.
You mock at me. But I will give you one last irrefutable proof. Madame Renaud's story was false. A fabrication from beginning to end. We believe Madame Renaud to have loved her husband, yet she lied to shield his murderer. For whom will a woman lie? Sometimes for herself, usually for the man she loves, always for her children. That is the last, the irrefutable proof. You cannot get round it.
Giraud paused, flushed and triumphant. Poirot regarded him steadily.
That is my case, said Giraud. What have you to say to it?
Only that there is one thing you have failed to take into account.
What is that?
Jacques Renaud was presumably acquainted with the planning out of the golf course. He knew that the body would be discovered almost at once, when they started to dig the bunker.
Giraud laughed out loud. But it is idiotic what you say there. He wanted the body to be found. Unless it was found, he could not presume death, and would not have been able to enter into his inheritance.
I saw a quick flash of green in Poirot's eyes as he rose to his feet.
Then why bury it? He asked very softly. Reflect, Giraud. Since it was to Jacques Renaud's advantage that the body should be found without delay, why dig a grave at all?
Giraud did not reply. The question found him unprepared. He shrugged his shoulders as though to intimate that it was of no importance. Poirot moved towards the door. I followed him.
There is one more thing that you have failed to take into account, he said over his shoulder.
What is that?
The piece of lead piping, said Poirot, and left the room.
Jacques Renaud still stood in the hall with a white, dumb face, but as we came out of the salon he looked up sharply. At the same moment there was the sound of a footfall on the staircase. Mrs. Renaud was descending it. At the sight of her son standing between the two myrmidons of the law, she stopped as though petrified.
Jack, she faltered. Jack, what is this?
He looked up at her, his face set.
They have arrested me, mother.
What?
She uttered a piercing cry, and before anyone could get to her, swayed and fell heavily. We both ran to her and lifted her up. In a minute, Poirot stood up again.
She has cut her head badly on the corner of the stairs. I fancy there is slight concussion also. If Giraud wants a statement from her, he will have to wait.
She will probably be unconscious for at least a week. Denise and Françoise had run to their mistress, and leaving her in their charge, Poirot left the house. He walked with his head down, frowning thoughtfully. For some time I did not speak, but at last I ventured to put a question to him. Do you believe, then, in spite of all appearances to the contrary, that Jack Renaud may not be guilty? Poirot did not answer at once, but after a long wait he said gravely,
I do not know, Hastings. There is just a chance of it.
Of course, Giraud is all wrong, wrong from beginning to end. If Jack Renaud is guilty, it is in spite of Giraud's arguments, not because of them. And the gravest indictment against him is known only to me.
What is that? I asked, impressed.
If you would use your gray cells and see the whole case clearly as I do, you too would perceive it, my friend.
This was what I called one of Poirot's irritating answers. He went on, without waiting for me to speak,
Let us walk this way to the sea. We will sit on that little mound there overlooking the beach and review the case. You shall know all that I know, but I would prefer that you should come at the truth by your own efforts, not by my leading you by the hand.
We established ourselves on the grassy knoll, as Poirot had suggested, looking out to sea.
Think, my friend, said Poirot's voice encouragingly. Arrange your ideas. Be methodical. Be orderly. That is the secret of success.
I endeavored to obey him, casting my mind back over all the details of the case. And suddenly, I started as an idea of bewildering luminosity shot into my brain. Tremblingly, I built up my hypothesis.
You have a little idea. I see, mon ami.
Capital. We progress.
I sat up and lit a pipe.
Poirot, I said,
it seems to me we've been strangely remiss. I say we, although I dare say I would be nearer the mark, but you must pay the penalty of your determined secrecy. So I say again, we have been strangely remiss. There is someone we've forgotten.
And who is that? Inquired Poirot with twinkling eyes.
Georges Corneau.
Chapter 20.
an amazing statement. The next moment, Poirot embraced me warmly on the cheek.
Enfin, you have arrived, and all by yourself. It is superb. Continue your reasoning. You are right. Decidedly, we have done wrong to forget Georges Cournot.
I was so flattered by the little man's approval that I could hardly continue, but at last I collected my thoughts and went on. Georges Cournot disappeared 20 years ago, but we have no reason to believe that he is dead.
Aucunement, agreed Poirot.
Proceed. Therefore, we will assume that he is alive.
Exactly.
Or that he was alive until recently.
De mieux en mieux.
We will presume, I continued, my enthusiasm rising, that he has fallen on evil days. He has become a criminal, an Apache, a tramp, a what you will. He chances to come to Merlinville. There he finds the woman he has never ceased to love.
The sentimentality, warned Poirot.
Where one hates, one also loves, I quoted, or misquoted. At any rate, he finds her there, living under an assumed name, but she has a new lover, the Englishman, Renault. Georges Cournot, the memory of old wrongs rising in him, quarrels with this Renault. He lies in wait for him as he comes to visit his mistress and stabs him in the back. Then, terrified at what he has done, he starts to dig a grave. I imagine it likely that Madame d'Aubray comes out to look for her lover. She and Cournot have a terrible scene. He drags her into the shed and there suddenly falls down in an epileptic fit. Now, supposing Jack Renault to appear, Madame d'Aubray tells him all. Points out to him the dreadful consequences to her daughter if this scandal of the past is revived. His father's murderer is dead. Let them do their best to hush it up. Jack Renault consents, goes to the house, and has an interview with his mother, winning her over to his point of view. Primed with the story that Madame d'Aubray has suggested to him, she permits herself to be gagged and bound. There, Poirot, what do you think of that? I leaned back, flushed with the pride of successful reconstruction. Poirot looked at me thoughtfully.
I think that you should write for the kinema, mon ami, he remarked at last.
Well, you mean
it would mean a good film? The story that you have accounted to me there, but it bears no sort of resemblance to everyday life.
Well, I admit that I haven't got into all the details, but
you have gone farther. You have ignored them magnificently. What about the way the two men were dressed?
Do you suggest that after stabbing his victim, Cournot removed his suit of clothes, donned it himself, and replaced the dagger?
Well, I don't see that that matters, I objected rather huffily. He may have obtained clothes and money from Madame d'Aubray, by threats earlier in the day.
By threats, sir?
You seriously advance that supposition?
Well, certainly. He could have threatened to reveal her identity to the Renaults, which would probably have put an end to all hopes of her daughter's marriage.
You are wrong, Hastings. He could not blackmail her, for she had the whip hand. Georges Cournot, remember, is still wanted for murder. A word from her, and he is in danger of the guillotine.
I was forced, rather reluctantly, to admit the truth of this.
Your theory, I remarked acidly, is doubtless correct as to all the details.
My theory is the truth, said Poirot quietly. And the truth is necessarily correct. In your theory, you made a fundamental error. You permitted your imagination to lead you astray with midnight assignations and passionate love scenes. But in investigating crime, we must take our stand upon the commonplace. Shall I demonstrate my methods to you?
Oh, by all means, let's have a demonstration.
Poirot sat very upright and began, wagging his forefinger emphatically to emphasize his points. I will start as you started, from the basic fact of Georges Cournot. Now, the story told by Madame Beraudy in court as to the Russians was admittedly a fabrication. If she was innocent of connivance in the crime, it was concocted by her, and by her only, as she stated. If, on the other hand, she was not innocent, it might have been invented by either her or Georges Cournot. Now, in this case we are investigating, we meet the same tale. As I pointed out to you, the facts render it very unlikely that Madame d'Aubray inspired it. So we turn to the hypothesis that the story had its origin in the brain of Georges Cournot.
Very good.
Georges Cournot, therefore, planned the crime, with Mrs. Renault as his accomplice. She is in the limelight, and behind her is a shadowy figure whose present alias is unknown to us. Now let us go carefully over the Renault case from the beginning, setting down each significant point in its chronological order. You have a notebook and pencil?
Good. Now, what is the earliest point to note down? The letter to you? That was the first we knew of it, but it is not the proper beginning of the case. The first point of any significance, I should say, is the change that came over Monsieur Renaud shortly after arriving in Merlinville, and which is attested to by several witnesses. We have also to consider his friendship with Madame d'Aubray, and the large sums of money paid over to her. From thence we can come directly to the 23rd of May. Poirot paused, cleared his throat, and signed to me to write, 23rd May. Monsieur Renaud quarrels with his son over Latta's wish to marry Marthe d'Aubray. Son leaves for Paris. 24th May. Monsieur Renaud alters his will, leaving entire control of his fortune in his wife's hands. 7th June. Quarrel with tramp in garden, witnessed by Marthe d'Aubray. Letter written to Monsieur Hercule Poirot, imploring assistance. Telegram sent to Monsieur Jacques Renaud, bidding him proceed by the Anzora to Buenos Aires. Chauffeur, masters, sent off on a holiday. Visit of a lady that evening. As he is seeing her out, his words are, yes, yes, but for God's sake, go now. Poirot paused. There, Hastings. Take each of these facts one by one, consider them carefully by themselves and in relation to the whole, and see if you do not get new light on the matter. I endeavored conscientiously to do as he had said. After a moment or two, I said rather doubtfully, as to the first point, the question seems to be whether we adopt the theory of blackmail or of an infatuation for this woman. Blackmail, decidedly. You heard what Stoner said as to his character and habits. Mrs. Renaud did not confirm his view, I argued. We have already seen that Madame Renaud's testimony cannot be relied upon in any way. We must trust to Stoner on that point. Still, if Renaud had an affair with a woman called Bella, there seems no inherent improbability in his having another with Madame d'Aubray. None whatever, I grant you, Hastings, but did he? The letter, Poirot. You forget the letter. No, I do not forget. But what makes you think that the letter was written to Monsieur Renaud? Why, it was found in his pocket, and that is all, cut in Poirot. There was no mention of any name to show to whom the letter was addressed. We assumed it was to the dead man because it was in the pocket of his overcoat. Now, mon ami, something about that overcoat struck me as unusual. I measured it, and made the remark that he wore his overcoat very long. That remark should have given you to think. I thought you were just saying it for the sake of saying something, I confessed. Ha, quelle idée! Later you observed me measuring the overcoat of Monsieur Jacques Renaud. Eh bien, Monsieur Jacques Renaud wears his overcoat very short. Put those two facts together with a third, namely that Monsieur Jacques Renaud flung out of the house in a hurry on his departure for Paris, and tell me what you make of it. I see, I said slowly, as the meaning of Poirot's remarks bore in on me. That letter was written to Jacques Renaud, not to his father. He caught up the wrong overcoat in his haste and agitation. Poirot nodded. Précisément. We can return to this point later. For the moment, let us content ourselves with accepting the letter as having nothing to do with Monsieur Renaud père, and pass on to the next chronological event. 23rd May, I read. Monsieur Renaud quarrels with his son over Latta's wish to marry Marthe d'Aubray. Son leaves for Paris. I don't see anything much to remark upon there. And the altering of the will the following day seems straightforward enough. It was the direct result of the quarrel. We agree, mon ami, at least as to the cause. But what exact motive underlay this procedure of Monsieur Renaud's? I opened my eyes in surprise. Anger against his son, of course. Yet he wrote him affectionate letters to Paris. So Jacques Renaud says, but he cannot produce them. Well, let us pass from that. Well, now we come to the day of the tragedy. You've placed the events of the morning in a certain order. Have you any justification for that? I have ascertained that the letter to me was posted at the same time as the telegram was dispatched. Masters was informed he could take a holiday shortly afterwards. In my opinion, the quarrel with the tramp took place anterior to these happenings. Oh, I don't see that you can fix that definitely, unless you question Madame d'Aubray again. There is no need, I am sure of it. And if you do not see that, you see nothing, Hastings. I looked at him for a moment. Of course, I'm an idiot. If the tramp was Georges Corneau, it was after the stormy interview with him that Mr. Renaud apprehended danger. He sent away the chauffeur, Masters, whom he suspected of being in the other's pay. He wired to his son and sent for you. A faint smile crossed Poirot's lips.
You do not think it strange that he should use exactly the same expressions in his letter as Madame Renaud used, later in her story?
If the mention of Santiago was a blind, why should Renaud speak of it? What is more, send his son there. It is puzzling, I admit, but perhaps we shall find some explanation later. We come now to the evening, and the visit of the mysterious lady. I confess that that fairly baffles me, unless it was indeed Madame de Breuil, as Françoise all along maintained.
Poirot shook his head. My friend, where are your wits wandering? Remember the fragment of the cheque, and the fact that the name Bella Duveen was faintly familiar to Stoner, and I think we may take it for granted that Bella Duveen is the full name of Jack's unknown correspondent, and that it was she who came to the Villa Genevieve that night. Whether she intended to see Jack, or whether she meant all along to appeal to his father, we cannot be certain. But I think we may assume that this is what occurred. She produced her claim upon Jack, probably showed letters that he had written to her, and the older man tried to buy her off by writing a check. This she indignantly tore up. The terms of her letter are those of a woman genuinely in love, and she would probably deeply resent being offered money. In the end, he got rid of her. And here, the words that he used are significant. Yes, yes, but for God's sake, go now, I repeated. They seem to me a little vehement, perhaps. That is all. That is enough. He was desperately anxious for the girl to go. Why? Not because the interview was unpleasant, no. It was the time that was slipping by, and for some reason, time was precious. Well, why should it be? I asked, bewildered. That is what we ask ourselves. Why should it be? But later, we have the incident of the wristwatch, which again shows us that time plays a very important part in the crime. We are now fast approaching the actual drama. It is 10:30 when Bella Duveen leaves, and by the evidence of the wristwatch, we know that the crime was committed, or at any rate, that it was staged, before 12:00. We have reviewed all the events anterior to the murder. There remains only one unplaced. By the doctor's evidence, the tramp, when found, had been dead at least 48 hours, with a possible margin of 24 hours more. Now, with no other facts to help me than those we have discussed, I placed the death as having occurred on the morning of 7th June. I stared at him, stupefied. But how? Why? How can you possibly know? Because only in that way can the sequence of events be logically explained. Mon ami, I have taken you step by step along the way. Do you not now see what is so glaringly plain? My dear Poirot, I can't see anything glaring about it. I did think I was beginning to see my way before, but I'm now hopelessly fogged. For goodness sake, get on and tell me who killed Monsieur Renaud. That is what I am not sure of as yet. But you said it was glaringly clear. We talk at cross purposes, my friend. Remember, it is two crimes we are investigating, for which, as I pointed out to you, we have the necessary two bodies. There, there. Ne vous impatientez pas. I explain all. To begin with, we apply our psychology. We find three points at which Monsieur Renaud displays a distinct change of view and action. Three psychological points, therefore. The first occurs immediately after arriving in Merlinville. The second, after quarrelling with his son on a certain subject. The third, on the morning of 7th June. Now, for the three causes. We can attribute number 1 to meeting Madame Dobray. Number 2 is indirectly connected with her, since it concerns a marriage between Monsieur Renaud's son and her daughter. But the cause of number 3 is hidden from us. We had to deduce it. Now, mon ami, let me ask you a question. Whom do we believe to have planned this crime? Georges Corneau? I said doubtfully, eyeing Poirot warily. Exactly. Now, Giraud laid it down as an axiom that a woman lies to save herself, the man she loves, and her child. Since we are satisfied that it was Georges Corneau who dictated the lie to her, and as Georges Corneau is not Jack Renaud, it follows that the third case is put out of court. And still attributing the crime to Georges Corneau, the first is equally so. So we are forced to the second,
that Madame Renaud lied for the sake of the man she loved, or in other words, for the sake of Georges Renaud. You agree to that?
Yes, I admitted. It seems logical enough.
Bien. Madame Renaud loves Georges Renaud. Who then is Georges Renaud?
The tramp.
Have we any evidence to show that Madame Renaud loved the tramp?
No, but
very well then. Do not cling to theories where facts no longer support them. Ask yourself instead whom Madame Renaud did love.
I shook my head, perplexed.
Mais oui, you know perfectly. Whom did Madame Renaud love so dearly that when she saw his dead body, she fell down in a swoon?
I stared, dumbfounded.
Her husband, I gasped.
Poirot nodded.
Her husband. Or Georges Renaud.
Whichever you like to call him.
I rallied myself.
But it's impossible.
How impossible? Did we not agree just now that Madame Dobray was in a position to blackmail Georges Renaud?
Yes, but...
And did she not very effectively blackmail Monsieur Renaud?
Well, that may be true enough, but...
And is it not a fact that we know nothing of Monsieur Renaud's youth and upbringing, that he springs suddenly into existence as a French-Canadian exactly 22 years ago?
Well, all that is so, I said more firmly, but you seem to me to be overlooking one salient point.
What is that, my friend?
Why, we've admitted that George planned the crime.
That brings us to the ridiculous statement that he planned his own murder.
Eh bien, mon ami, said Poirot placidly, that is just what he did do.
Chapter 21. Hercule Poirot on the Case. In a measured voice, Poirot began his exposition.
It seems strange to you, mon ami, that a man should plan his own death. So strange that you prefer to reject the truth as fantastic, and to revert to a story that is in reality 10 times more impossible. Yes, Monsieur Renaud planned his own death. But there is one detail that perhaps escapes you. He did not intend to die.
I shook my head, bewildered.
But no. It is all most simple, really, said Poirot kindly. For the crime that Monsieur Renaud proposed, a murderer was not necessary, as I told you, but a body was. Let us reconstruct, seeing events this time from a different angle. Georges Renaud flies from justice to Canada. There, under an assumed name, he marries and finally acquires a vast fortune in South America. But there is a nostalgia upon him for his own country. 20 years have elapsed. He has considerably changed in appearance. Besides being a man of such eminence that no one is likely to connect him with a fugitive from justice many years ago. He deems it quite safe to return. He takes up his headquarters in England, but intends to spend the summers in France. And ill fortune, or that obscure justice which shapes men's ends and will not allow them to evade the consequences of their acts, takes him to Merlinville. There, in the whole of France, is the one person who is capable of recognizing him. It is, of course, a gold mine to Madame Dobray, and a gold mine of which she is not slow to take advantage. He is helpless, absolutely in her power, and she bleeds him heavily. And then the inevitable happens. Jack Renaud falls in love with the beautiful girl he sees almost daily and wishes to marry her. That arouses his father. At all costs, he will prevent his son marrying the daughter of this evil woman. Jack Renaud knows nothing of his father's past, but Madame Renaud knows everything. She is a woman of great force of character and passionately devoted to her husband. They take counsel together. Renaud sees only one way of escape, death. He must appear to die. In reality, escaping to another country, where he will start again under an assumed name, and where Madame Renaud, having played the widow's part for a while, can join him. It is essential that he should have control of the money, so he alters his will. How they meant to manage the body business originally, I do not know. Possibly an art student's skeleton and a fire, or something of the kind. But long before their plans have matured, an event occurs which plays into their hands. A rough tramp, violent and abusive, finds his way into the garden. There is a struggle. Renaud seeks to eject him, and suddenly the tramp, an epileptic, falls down in a fit. He is dead. Renaud calls his wife. Together they drag him into the shed. As we know, the event had occurred just outside, and they realize the marvelous opportunity that has been vouchsafed them. The man bears no resemblance to Renaud, but he is middle-aged, of a usual French type. That is sufficient. I rather fancy that they sat on a bench up there, out of earshot from the house, discussing matters. Their plan was quickly made. The identification must rest solely on Madame Renaud's evidence. Jacques Renaud and the chauffeur, who had been with his master 2 years, must be got out of the way. It was unlikely that the French women servants would go near the body, and in any case Renaud intended to take measures to deceive anyone not likely to appreciate details. Masters was sent off, a telegram dispatched to Jack, Buenos Aires being selected to give credence to the story that Renaud had decided upon. Having heard of me as a rather obscure, elderly detective, he wrote his appeal for help, knowing that when I arrived the production of the letter would have a profound effect upon the examining magistrate, which of course it did. They dressed the body of the tramp in a suit of Renaud's, and left his ragged coat and trousers by the door of the shed, not daring to take them into the house. And then, to give credence to the tale Madame Renaud was to tell, they drove the aeroplane dagger through his heart. That night, Renaud would first bind and gag his wife, and then, taking a spade, will dig a grave in that particular plot of ground where he knows a, how do you call it, a bunker, is to be made. It is essential that the body should be found. Madame Dobray must have no suspicions. On the other hand, if a little time elapses, any dangers as to identity will be greatly lessened. Then Renaud will don the tramp's rags and shuffle off to the station, where he will leave, unnoticed, by the 12:10 train. Since the crime will be supposed to have taken place 2 hours later, no suspicion can possibly attach to him. You see now his annoyance at the inopportune visit of the girl Bella. Every moment of delay is fatal to his plans. He gets rid of her as soon as he can, however. Then to work. He leaves the front door slightly ajar to create the impression that assassins left that way. He binds and gags Madame Renaud, correcting his mistake of 22 years ago, when the looseness of the bonds caused suspicion to fall upon his accomplice, but leaving her primed with essentially the same story as he had invented before, proving the unconscious recall of the mind against originality. The night is chilly, and he slips on an overcoat over his underclothing, intending to cast it into the grave with the dead man. He goes out by the window, smoothing over the flowerbed carefully, and thereby furnishing the most positive evidence against himself. He goes out onto the lonely golf links, and he digs. And then, yes, and then, said Poirot gravely, the justice that he has so long eluded overtakes him. An unknown hand stabs him in the back. Now, Hastings, you understand what I mean when I talk of two crimes. The first crime, the crime that Monsieur Renaud, in his arrogance, asked us to investigate, is solved. But behind it lies a deeper riddle. And to solve that will be difficult, since the criminal, in his wisdom, has been content to avail himself of the devices prepared by Renaud. It has been a particularly perplexing and baffling mystery to solve. You're marvelous, Poirot, I said, with admiration, absolutely marvelous. No one on earth but you would have done it. I think my praise pleased him. For once in his life, he looked almost embarrassed. That poor Giraud, said Poirot, trying unsuccessfully to look modest. Without doubt, it is not all stupidity. He has had la mauvaise chance once or twice, that dark hair coiled round the dagger, for instance. To say the least, it was misleading. To tell you the truth, Poirot, I said slowly, even now, I don't quite see. Whose hair was it? Madame Renaud's, of course. That is where la mauvaise chance came in. Her hair, dark originally, is almost completely silvered. It might just as easily have been a grey hair. And then, by no conceivable effort, could Giraud have persuaded himself it came from the head of Jacques Renaud. But it is all of a piece. Always, the facts must be twisted to fit the theory. Without doubt, when Madame Renaud recovers, she will speak. The possibility of her son being accused of the murder never occurred to her. How should it? When she believed him safely at sea, on board the Anzora. Ah, voilà, infâme, Hastings, what force! What self-command! She made only one slip, on his unexpected return. It does not matter, now. And no one noticed. No one realized the significance of those words. What a terrible part she has had to play, poor woman. Imagine the shock when she goes to identify the body, and instead of what she expects, sees the actual lifeless form of the husband she has believed miles away by now. No wonder she fainted. But since then, despite her grief and her despair, how resolutely she has played her part, and how the anguish of it must wring her. She cannot say a word to set us on the track of the real murderers. For her son's sake, no one must know that Paul Renault was Georges Conneau, the criminal. Final and most bitter blow, she has admitted publicly that Madame d'Aubray was her husband's mistress. For a hint of blackmail might be fatal to her secret. How cleverly she dealt with the examining magistrate when he asked her if there was any mystery in her husband's past life. Nothing so romantic, I am sure, monsieur. It was perfect. The indulgent tone, the soupçon of sad mockery. At once, Monsieur Hotet felt himself foolish and melodramatic. Yes, she is a great woman. If she loved the criminal, she loved him royally. Poirot lost himself in contemplation. One more thing, Poirot. What about the piece of lead piping? You do not see? To disfigure the victim's face, so that it would be unrecognizable. It was that which first set me on the right track, and that imbecile of a Giraud, swarming all over the place to look for match ends. Did I not tell you that a clue of 2 foot long was quite as good as a clue of 2 inches? You see, Hastings, we must now start again. Who killed Monsieur Renault? Someone who was near the villa just before 12 o'clock that night, someone who would benefit by his death. The description fits Jack Renault only too well. The crime need not have been premeditated. And then the dagger. I started. I had not realized that point. Of course, I said. Mrs. Renault's dagger was the second one we found in the tramp. There were two, then. Certainly. And since they were duplicates, it stands to reason that Jack Renault was the owner. But that would not trouble me so much. In fact, I had a little idea as to that. No, the worst indictment against him is again psychological. Heredity. Mon ami, heredity. Like father, like son. Jack Renault, when all is said and done, is the son of Georges Conneau. His tone was grave and earnest, and I was impressed in spite of myself. What is your little idea that you mentioned just now? I asked. For answer, Poirot consulted his turnip-faced watch, and then asked, What time is the afternoon boat from Calais? About 5, I believe. That will do very well. We shall just have time. You're going to England? Yes, my friend. Why? To find a possible witness. Who? With a rather peculiar smile on his face, Poirot replied, Miss Bella Duveen. But how will you find her? What do you know about her? I know nothing about her, but I can guess a good deal. We may take it for granted that her name is Bella Duveen, and since that name was faintly familiar to Monsieur Stoner, though evidently not in connection with the Renault family, it is probable that she is on the stage. Jack Renault was a young man with plenty of money and 20 years of age. The stage is sure to have been the home of his first love. It tallies, too, with Monsieur Renault's attempt to placate her with a check. I think I shall find her all right, especially with the help of this. And he brought out the photograph I had seen him take from Jack Renault's drawer. With love from Bella was scrawled across the corner. But it was not that which held my eyes fascinated. The likeness was not first rate, but for all that it was unmistakable to me. I felt a cold sinking, as though some unutterable calamity had befallen me. It was the face of Cinderella. Chapter 22 I Find Love. For a moment or two I sat as though frozen, the photograph still in my hand. Then, summoning all my courage to appear unmoved, I handed it back. At the same time, I stole a quick glance at Poirot. Had he noticed anything? But to my relief, he did not seem to be observing me. Anything unusual in my manner had certainly escaped him. He rose briskly to his feet. We have no time to lose. We must make our departure with all dispatch. All is well. The sea, it will be calm. In the bustle of departure, I had no time for thinking. But once on board the boat, secure from Poirot's observation, I pulled myself together and attacked the facts dispassionately. How much did Poirot know? And why was he bent on finding this girl? Did he suspect her of having seen Jack Renault commit the crime? Or did he suspect... But that was impossible. The girl had no grudge against the elder Renault, no possible motive for wishing his death. What had brought her back to the scene of the murder? I went over the facts carefully. She must have left the train at Calais, where I parted from her that day. No wonder I had been unable to find her on the boat. If she had dined in Calais and then taken a train out to Merlinville, she would have arrived at the Villa Genevieve just about the time that Françoise said. What had she done when she left the house just after 10? Presumably, either gone to an hotel or returned to Calais. And then? The crime had been committed on Tuesday night. On Thursday morning, she was once more in Merlinville. Had she ever left France at all? I doubted it very much. What kept her there? The hope of seeing Jack Renault? I had told her, as at the time we believed, that he was on the high seas en route to Buenos Aires. Possibly she was aware that the Anzora had not sailed. But to know that, she must have seen Jack. Was that what Poirot was after? Had Jack Renault, returning to see Marthe Dobreuil, come face to face instead with Bella Duveen, the girl he had heartlessly thrown over? I began to see daylight. If that were indeed the case, it might furnish Jack with the alibi he needed. Yet under those circumstances, his silence seemed difficult to explain. Why could he not have spoken out boldly? Did he fear for this former entanglement of his to come to the ears of Marthe Dobreuil? I shook my head, dissatisfied. The thing had been harmless enough, a foolish boy and girl affair, and I reflected cynically that the son of a millionaire was not likely to be thrown over by a penniless French girl, who moreover loved him devotedly, without a much graver cause. Poirot reappeared, brisk and smiling, at Dover, and our journey to London was uneventful. It was past 9 o'clock when we arrived, and I supposed that we should return straight away to our rooms and do nothing till the morning, but Poirot had other plans. "We must lose no time, mon ami. The news of the arrest will not be in the English papers until the day after tomorrow, but still, we must lose no time." I did not quite follow his reasoning, but I merely asked how he proposed to find the girl. "You remember Joseph Aarons, the theatrical agent, no? I assisted him in a little matter of a Japanese wrestler. A pretty little problem. I must recount it to you one day. He, without doubt, will be able to put us in the way of finding out what we want to know." It took us some time to run Mr. Aarons to earth, and it was after midnight when we finally managed it. He greeted Poirot with every evidence of warmth, and professed himself ready to be of service to us in any way. "There's not much about the profession I don't know," he said, beaming genially. "Eh bien, Monsieur Aarons, I desire to find a young girl called Bella Duveen." "Bella Duveen? Well, I know the name, but for a moment I can't place it. What's her line?" "That I do not know, but here is her photograph." Mr. Aarons studied it for a moment, then his face lighted. "Got it," he slapped his thigh. "The Dulcibella kids, by the Lord."
"The Dulcibella kids?"
"That's it. They're sisters, acrobats, dancers, and singers. Give quite a good little turn. They're in the provinces somewhere, I believe, if they're not resting. They've been on in Paris for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Can you find out for me exactly where they are?"
"Easy as a bird. You go home, I'll send you round the dope in the morning."
With this promise, we took leave of him. He was as good as his word. About 11 o'clock the following day, a scribbled note reached us. "The Dulcibella sisters are on at the palace in Coventry. Good luck to you."
Without more ado, we started for Coventry. Poirot made no inquiries at the theatre, but contented himself with booking stalls for the variety performance that evening. The show was wearisome beyond words, or perhaps it was only my mood that made it seem so. Japanese families balanced themselves precariously. Would-be fashionable men in greenish evening dress and exquisitely slicked hair reeled off society patter and danced marvellously. Stout prima donnas sang at the top of the human register. A comic comedian endeavoured to be Mr. George Robey, and failed signally. At last the number went up which announced the Dulcibella kids. My heart beat sickeningly. There she was. There they both were, the pair of them, one flaxen-haired, one dark, matching as to size, with short fluffy skirts and immense buster-brown bows. They looked a pair of extremely piquant children. They began to sing. Their voices were fresh and true, rather thin and music-hally, but attractive. It was quite a pretty little turn. They danced neatly and did some clever little acrobatic feats. The words of their songs were crisp and catchy. When the curtain fell, there was a full meed of applause. Evidently, the Dulcibella kids were a success. Suddenly I felt that I could remain no longer. I must get out into the air. I suggested leaving to Poirot.
Go by all means, mon ami. I amuse myself, and will stay to the end. I will rejoin you later.
It was only a few steps from the theatre to the hotel. I went up to the sitting room, ordered a whiskey and soda, and sat drinking it, staring meditatively into the empty grate. I heard the door open and turned my head, thinking it was Poirot. Then I jumped to my feet. It was Cinderella who stood in the doorway. She spoke haltingly, her breath coming in little gasps.
I saw you in front. You and your friend. When you got up to go, I was waiting outside and followed you.
Why are you here? In Coventry? What were you doing there tonight? Is the man who was with you... the detective?
She stood there, the cloak she had wrapped round her stage dress slipping from her shoulders. I saw the whiteness of her cheeks under the rouge and heard the terror in her voice, and in that moment I understood everything, understood why Poirot was seeking her and what she feared, and understood at last my own heart. Yes, I said gently.
Is he looking for me?
She half-whispered. Then, as I did not answer for a moment, she slipped down by the big chair and burst into violent, bitter weeping. I knelt down by her, holding her in my arms and smoothing the hair back from her face.
Don't cry, child. Don't cry, for God's sake. You're safe here. I'll take care of you. Don't cry, darling. Don't cry.
I know. I know everything.
Oh, but you don't.
I think I do. And after a moment, as her sobs grew quieter, I asked, It was you who took the dagger, wasn't it?
Yes.
That was why you wanted me to show you round, and why you pretended to faint. Again she nodded.
Why did you take the dagger? I asked presently.
She replied, as simply as a child,
I was afraid there might be finger marks on it.
But didn't you remember that you had worn gloves? She shook her head as though bewildered, and then said slowly,
Are you going to give me up? To the police?
Good God, no. Her eyes sought mine long and earnestly, and then she asked, in a little quiet voice that sounded afraid of itself,
Why not?
It seemed a strange place, and a strange time for a declaration of love, and God knows, in all my imagining, I had never pictured love coming to me in such a guise. But I answered simply, and naturally enough, Because I love you, Cinderella. She bent her head down as though ashamed, and muttered in a broken voice,
You can't. You can't, not if you knew.
And then, as though rallying herself, she faced me squarely and asked,
What do you know, then?
I know that you came to see Mr. Renault that night. He offered you a check, and you tore it up indignantly. Then you left the house. I paused.
Go on. What next?
I don't know whether you knew Jack Renault would be coming that night, or whether you just waited about on the chance of seeing him, but you did wait about. Perhaps you were just miserable and walked aimlessly, but at any rate, just before 12, you were still near there, and you saw a man on the golf links. Again I paused. I had leapt to the truth in a flash as she entered the room, but now the picture rose before me even more convincingly. I saw vividly the peculiar pattern of the overcoat on the dead body of Mr. Renault, and I remembered the amazing likeness that had startled me into believing for one instant that the dead man had risen from the dead when his son burst into our conclave in the salon.
Go on, repeated the girl steadily.
I fancy his back was to you, but you recognized him, or thought you recognized him. The gate and the carriage were familiar to you, and the pattern of his overcoat. I paused. You used a threat in one of your letters to Jack Renault. When you saw him there, your anger and jealousy drove you mad and you struck. I don't believe for a minute that you meant to kill him. But you did kill him, Cinderella. She had flung up her hands to cover her face, and in a choked voice she said,
You're right. You're right. I can see it all as you tell it.
Then she turned on me, almost savagely.
And you love me? Knowing what you do, how can you love me?
I don't know, I said a little wearily. I think love is like that, a thing one cannot help. I have tried, I know, ever since the first day I met you, and love has been too strong for me. And then suddenly, when I least expected it, she broke down again, casting herself down on the floor and sobbing wildly.
Oh, I can't, she cried. I don't know what to do. I don't know which way to turn. Oh, pity me, pity me. Someone, and tell me what to do.
Again I knelt by her, soothing her as best I could. Don't be afraid of me, Bella, for God's sake, don't be afraid of me. I love you, that's true, but I don't want anything in return. Only let me help you. Love him still if you have to, but let me help you, as he can't. It was as though she had been turned to stone by my words. She raised her head from her hands and stared at me.
You think that? She whispered. You think that I love Jack Renault?
Then, half laughing, half crying, she flung her arms passionately round my neck and pressed her sweet, wet face to mine.
Not as I love you, she whispered. Never as I love you.
Her lips brushed my cheek, and then, seeking my mouth, kissed me again and again with a sweetness and fire beyond belief. The wildness of it, and the wonder, I shall not forget. No, not as long as I live. It was a sound in the doorway that made us look up. Poirot was standing there looking at us. I did not hesitate. With a bound, I reached him and pinioned his arms to his sides.
Quick, I said to the girl, get out of here, as fast as you can. I'll hold him.
With one look at me, she fled out of the room past us. I held Poirot in a grip of iron.
Mon ami, observed the latter mildly, you do this sort of thing very well. The strong man holds me in his grasp, and I am helpless as a child. But all this is uncomfortable and slightly ridiculous. Let us sit down and be calm.
You won't pursue her?
Mon Dieu, no. Am I Giraud?
Release me, my friend.
Keeping a suspicious eye upon him, for I paid Poirot the compliment of knowing that I was no match for him in astuteness, I relaxed my grip, and he sank into an armchair, feeling his arms tenderly.
It is that you have the strength of a bull when you are roused, Hastings.
Eh bien.
And do you think you have behaved well to your old friend?
I show you the girl's photograph, and you recognize it, but you never say a word.
Well, there was no need if you knew that I recognized it, I said rather bitterly. So Poirot had known all along. I had not deceived him for an instant.
Ta-ta. You did not know that I knew that, and tonight you help the girl to escape when we have found her with so much trouble.
Eh bien, it comes to this. Are you going to work with me or against me, Hastings?
For a moment or two, I did not answer. To break with my old friend gave me great pain. Yet I must definitely range myself against him. Would he ever forgive me? I wondered. He'd been strangely calm so far, but I knew him to possess marvellous self-command.
Poirot, I said, I'm sorry.
I admit I've behaved badly to you over this, but sometimes one has no choice. And in future I must take my own line. Poirot nodded his head several times.
I understand, he said.
The mocking light had quite died out of his eyes, and he spoke with a sincerity and kindness that surprised me.
It is that, my friend, is it not? It is love that has come, not as you imagined it, all cock-a-hoop with fine feathers, but sadly, with bleeding feet.
Well, well, I warned you. When I realized that this girl must have taken the dagger, I warned you.
Perhaps you remember. But already it was too late.
But tell me, how much do you know?
I met his eyes squarely. Nothing that you could tell me would be any surprise to me, Poirot. Understand that. But in case you think of resuming your search for Miss Duveen, I should like you to know one thing clearly. If you have any idea that she was concerned in the crime, or was the mysterious lady who called upon Mr. Renault that night, you are wrong. I travelled home from France with her that day, and parted from her at Victoria that evening, so that it is clearly impossible for her to have been in Merlinville.
Ah.
Poirot looked at me thoughtfully.
And you would swear to that? In a court of law?
Most certainly I would. Poirot rose and bowed.
Mon ami, vive l'amour! It can perform miracles. It is decidedly ingenious, what you have thought of there. It defeats even Hercule Poirot.